Yes.
All right, so once again, we delayed our delay. So what? Our last planned talk for today is Dave Phillips, known to some of you by his wonderful page of collections of links of thousands of Linux audio applications and related stuff. Something everyone should have in his bookmark list, at least I do. Also author of the Linux Audio and Music Applications book. I'm not sure if I quoted this correctly, but I think it was also quite important for the Linux scene to have a real book on this topic. I heard that a new review of this book is planned or something.
A new edition.
New edition, right. Okay, what you're going to talk about, I don't know. Honestly, his topic, we heard that Dave would come only very late when the program was already almost in print, so I just took something and wrote down historic developments of Linux or something in the audio field. What you're going to talk about may be different. I'll just be surprised myself. Here is Dave Phillips.
Thank you. I know that what a lot of you want to get to is the demonstration of all the applications, and I promise to at least try to make my presentation even shorter than Steve Harris's. So, unless there are any questions, thank you very much. I'd also like to warn you that one of my favorite lecturers was John Cage, so in true John Cage fashion, let me organize my notes. Random lecturing. Since Paul stole so much of my historical thunder in his own presentation, I decided that I would speak a little bit about documentation of Linux audio applications, any special problems or special solutions and so forth. And the more I thought about it, and especially the more I listened to everyone else's presentation, the more I realized there are no special problems. They're just the same problems that plague most software documentation. But there are some differences in sort of how it's done, how it's planned, and how it's realized. In commercial software development, of course, you have timetables, you have deadlines. Typically, it's like a stair-step release from version to version. Weeks go by, months go by, and then somebody notifies the documentation team, oh, well, we're ready to go with version 1.0, so whip us up the docs. Maybe they've been following, maybe the documentation writers have been following the progress of the application, whatever. But the point is that they have a fixed time. So the stair-step progress is pretty much what commercial writers of documentation get to follow. They have a plan. They have release dates. They got to come up with the goods. And I also want to stress they get paid for it. They spend a lot of time writing something that's not very easy to write, and they get paid for it. So if they don't make that, they don't get paid for it, and they're no longer professional documentation writers, or they're working for someone else. This is, say, typically the commercial model. Now, the best case scenario for open source development is, this is pre-alpha, and this is, oh, who knows what it is, it just keeps going up. Nice, smooth progression, but you notice that the documentation writer never gets a deadline date. So he's kind of stuck. You've got constantly evolving software. The unique problem, certainly as someone who writes books, articles, whatever, is that you're really plagued with this notion that no matter what you write, it's automatically out of date when it's published. And not just a little out of date or badly out of date, but this is Linux, so it's hideously out of date by the time it's published. So another worst case scenario is and this one's actually pretty easy to deal with. We start out with the pre-alpha, and we get to about 0.5, and then the developer goes, and I loved the phrase, missing in action. I thought that was pretty good. And finally, what is, in fact, probably the most typical scenario for the open source documentation writer. So, as you can see, there are special difficulties. Tough to deal with. I told Fernando that I was going to pick on Planet Karma a little bit. And actually, Fernando's description of his own problems with the documentation of Planet Karma are, they end up like that. You start with one plan and you end up with another and maybe go through four or five in between that one and the first one. Okay, so I'm going to pick on Planet Karma for a moment, but before I do, I would like to really stress, if you haven't tried Planet Karma, please do. I know Fernando sort of wants me to he's back there. No, please don't. But I'm telling you, please do, because, well, I like Fernando and all, but I like his Planet Karma even better. So, it's a wonderful thing, and I installed it on two different machines recently and ran into two completely different sets of problems, which raised the issue of, why aren't these things working? Why don't some things work? Some things do, some things don't. I would suggest that we work to take the mystery out of all of this. The magic we got to leave in, but the mystery would be awfully great to see it go. A lot of problems with documentation of open source audio projects have to do with the very nature of the relationship we have to the hardware, the fact that we sort of have to do it all ourselves. So we don't get a lot of help from manufacturers. As developers, all of you know, you're the ones who write the drivers. The people from ALSA, Paul, Jaroslav, if you buy a sound card, what drivers are included? Windows. Well, who wrote them? Well, Microsoft didn't. You can be sure about that. So Windows enjoys the patronage of the manufacturers. They get the drivers written for them. We don't. Everything has to be done in-house. We're the ones that do it all. So that's a difficulty. And to Planet Karma, and like I say, Fernando, if you want to take a break, go outside for a little while, whatever. The documentation for Planet Karma is, in fact, typical of some other excellent packages for Linux audio, in that it's very complete, but suffers from organization difficulties, readability difficulties. Fernando points out very logically, well, maybe it's not really aimed at the naive user. And to relate that to what I was just talking about, I believe that a lot of the difficulties of presenting Linux audio software will get minimized by the inclusion of ALSA into the kernel. Because, as Fernando pointed out to me in conversation, it will force the distributors to come up with superior installation and configuration routines. It will make them do that because they're going to get real tired of the kind of email and phone calls that we get now. A similar situation as regards documentation holds with SND. There's just so much of it. There's too much of it. I would suggest again that Fernando brought up the one-page installation guide. I was suggesting to him that it just needed one page. What I really mean by that is a simple step-by-step set of instructions where you just run through it in a best-case scenario. But the best-case scenario is going to depend at this point upon suggestions from the developers. In fact, not suggestions, flat-out recommendations for you use this sound card. You use this distribution. It has to be very, very specific. Whereas, for instance, in the Ardor, I believe in the Ardor README or in some of the documentation, it said if it's supported by ALSA, it should work with Ardor. Ay, ay, ay. That can really get you into some trouble with laptops. Because again, it relates to this fact that our relationship to the hardware manufacturers is simply not as smooth, not as easy as it is with Windows. So, if you're wondering, what does this have to do with documentation? Well, what about when things go wrong? When I wrote my book, my editors, were who do not use Linux at all, were very insistent upon extremely detailed explanations of things. I mean, if I used the term PCM without defining it, I got a message right back, what's PCM? Everything that was, you know, every acronym introduced in the book was defined the first time it appeared. So, the sort of ease of comprehension that the Windows users enjoy partially comes from they never really have to explain a whole lot to the end user. It's just assumed that it's going to work when it comes out of the box. I would suggest that if developers or anyone else here wants to write documentation, that you start from, especially after watching so many of our demonstrations here, that you propose that to yourself that it won't work out of the box and start from there. Start writing your documentation almost from a kind of negative point of view. Documentation is not fun. As Fernando pointed out, it's very difficult to write good documentation. It's very difficult to write complete documentation. It's time-consuming, and how do I want to put this? It requires writing skills. It requires good language skills. I was going to ask a couple questions here before I get too far into this, too. This question is not directed towards the developers. How many people here are actually using Linux? Not developers. Okay? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, there are, at least by the show of hands, a few people here who are not developers. I'm going to ask a couple other questions. By the way, if you think I'm like bouncing around like a pinball, that's because I'm bouncing around like a pinball with this. How many musicians are here? Ah, excellent. Wonderful. Excellent. And, of course, I know how many developers are here. How many people here are professional writers? Whoa, whoa. 1.5? Well, that kind of points up a problem we have. There aren't many people who are writing very good documentation for open source software because there aren't very many good writers who are willing to devote themselves to it. Again, if you're, I mean, a professional developer has an opportunity, say, to develop for some other operating system at a job somewhere. But professional writers, well, there aren't very many of them, period. So getting people to write excellent documentation, very high-quality documentation, is going to be hard. I guess I would have to call myself a professional writer now. It's not something I started out to be, but it's sort of what I'm doing for most of my living at this point. There aren't many other people doing it. And I would urge anyone who's interested in helping out with the development of Linux audio software who may not have, say, real high coding skills or know a lot about digital signal processing or whatever, get involved with the documentation. It's valuable. The developers all want it, but they're busy developing. They don't have the time or maybe even the skills to write very good documentation. I have some little further notes to add on the Planet Karma thing. Sorry, Fernando. Let me back up a little bit here. Pinball, pinball, pinball. Personally, I perceive documentation for any software, not just open source software, as there's essentially three types. There's the user-level documentation, which includes just your basic instructions, how to get it going, and then almost invariably, good user-level documentation launches into hands-on tutorials. This is what you do with it. This is how you use it. Not an explanation of how it works. Not an explanation of why it's there. They got the software. They know why it's there. They're going to use it. So you give them things to do with it immediately. I take my cue from that from the 18th century harpsichordist Francois Couperin. Couperin wrote a manual on harpsichord instruction. He did not, how should I put it, he discouraged teaching the reading of music notation to beginners. In fact, what Couperin recommended was that you teach beginners little pieces that they can memorize very quickly, that's what you start with right away. In other words, get them playing the harpsichord. It's the whole point of, you know, this instruction manual on playing the harpsichord. So it seems obvious, but there's not a whole lot of tutorial documentation for the software that's being produced. And the software is becoming extremely sophisticated. So, or I should say much more sophisticated than it was, say, 7 years ago. We would like to see then some more sophisticated tutorials. For instance, what does not exist? As far as I know, there are no user-level tutorials for, say, 24-track recording in Arter. How do you do it? How do you set it up? How do you even begin doing that? Somebody is going to have to take the time, get the hardware, set it all up, get people to come in and do it, and then write it up. And then the next people doing it will find it far easier to do the same thing. So you have, at the user level, basic install, configurations, real basic instructions on using the software, and then immediately into tutorial work. For developers, and I take developers' documentation very seriously as well, there are a number of tools you can use, of course, to generate documentation out of source code and so forth. I think developers have a pretty good handle on documentation in open source software, open source audio software, and open source software in general. I don't know how the developers feel about that, but it seems to me that there's certainly far more material for developers than there is for the end user. And finally, there's what the domain of what I call reference documentation, and this is problematic. If you take, say, the documentation for SND. It is an odd mixture of very detailed reference documentation with some kind of hands-on stuff thrown in. Well, this is a problem with what I refer to as organization or layout. In other words, you should never have to dig through or swim through reference documentation or any other documentation to get to the tutorials. I'm very big on getting your hands on the software and using it right away. I know this is a developers conference, but we're not writing this software for each other. The point is that it reaches end users, that it reaches musicians who want to use it. At least I think that's what this is about, so correct me if I'm wrong. And of course, there are a number of other considerations about documentation that the writer has to take into account. Format, is it going to be published, how's it going to appear, how am I going to keep it updated, so on and so forth. For instance, I've been discussing with some of the developers the need for, say, a second edition of my book. Myself, I'm kind of iffy about it right now. I'm beginning to think that I would wind up repeating, say, a lot of the work that Fernando's already done, or that Bill Schatzite's already done, or the quick tutorials. I don't want to plagiarize that work, so, you know, do I just want to rephrase what someone else has already written? I'm in a tough spot about that. To, like I say, pick on Planet Karma a little more, you're really getting it. Actually, Fernando's done a very good job of anticipating problems. It's kind of surprising, or at least I've been recently very surprised, I suppose I shouldn't be, by the lack of, say, troubleshooting guides for the end user. So, for instance, I love this one. I was installing Mandrake 8.2 recently on a couple machines and finally gave up on that. But when I was testing the sound card configuration, I thought this had to go down as one of the least helpful configuration tips I've ever seen. Are any of you familiar with Mandrake 8.2? It had some problems, and this was certainly one of them. You go to the sound card configuration, and it would identify your card, all right, and then it would say, do you want to test the sound card? And you go and you test it, and it says, now playing an 8-bit sample, blah, blah, blah. Did you hear the sound, yes or no? And if you clicked no, or if you clicked yes, well, if you clicked yes, you had no problems. But if you clicked no, that's it. It's the end. That's what I would call a lack of information. a severe lack of information. And what's worse, is that in the hard copy documentation, there's no more advice. So you're a new user, you're coming from Linux, you've heard all about it, and you go, and you know, you want to play like your ripped off MP3s, and so you like go and you got to configure your sound card and it doesn't work, so you dutifully open up the index and you say, oh, sound configuration. You go to the page and it says, to configure your sound card, use the sound configurator. Okay. Well, then what? Well, you know, if you got a support contract, or you know, if you've bought it and you've got a right to give them a holler, then you do that. Well, this is what I mean by forcing the distributions to improve the quality of their documentation as regards audio generally. Over the years, I've kind of felt like we're a sort of weak sister with a lot of what else goes on with Linux. And I feel like, well, that's with projects like Ardor, Planet Karma, and so many of the other, so much else of the work that's being done, that's no longer, that's a perceptual problem. It's definitely not true. We've kind of entered on a new time here with ALSA going into the kernel, with the development of Jack. Users are faced with actually a much more the possibility of a much more sophisticated sound system in Linux than we've ever had. I mean, it's, as Paul pointed out, historically it's been 16-bit, interleaved stereo sound. That's it. That was the presumption. And for that, you would think, oh, well, that should at least be out of the way. But it's not. The announcement on Slashdot that Paul mentioned, of course, elicited what I call slash noise from quite a few readers. And, of course, the real typical one was, my MP3s don't play, so Linux sucks. Well, there you go, you know. Well, they should play. I mean, honestly, you know, if you get, you know, open up Windows or the Mac, everything works fine, you know, at least for that. That's what I would call a kind of pre-basic configuration. That ought to be taken care of. And I don't believe that's ALSA's responsibility. I don't believe that that's the responsibility of the software writers. I believe that's the responsibility of the documentation people, or of the distributors, I'm sorry, that they're the ones who should make these routines, the installation and configuration routines, as transparent as possible, and with troubleshooting guides. What happens when things go wrong? Because this is Linux, and if you've been here for the last 2 days, you know things go wrong. And we're developers, you know, we say, well, you know, things go wrong, yeah, you know, and we're going to keep using Linux. The naive user is going to say, man, things went wrong, I'm back to Windows, you know. Well, that's not helpful. I think we need some better, not just better installation and configuration routines, but better documentation about what do you do when things go wrong. When I wrote my book, my editor kept pounding that home. He would say, well, you know, this is interesting, but you don't address, like, what happens when it doesn't work? You say, well, do this, do that, and you know, but you don't say, what if it doesn't work? What happens when things go wrong? What do I do then? Well, I wrote a little, there's a little bit of troubleshooting tips in my book, too, so it's not much. But what I found, just generally speaking, is that if you give users something, anything, it's like a lifeline, they'll at least hold on to that. And feel like, well, at least you tried to address the possibility of things going wrong. And again, this is Linux, so why don't we just assume things will go wrong? It's always in development. So, go further with the Planet Karma fund that I had, which, by the way, was, and I want to point this out, it really isn't Planet Karma's fault. It's not Fernando's fault that Mandrake 8.2 sucked. That's not his fault. But how can he possibly cover every difficulty that's going to come about from the proliferation of distributions, from the fact that we don't have the kind of hardware support that the Windows or the Mac users enjoy? Because these are conditions for creating real problems for the end user of Linux. So, for instance, okay, Fernando's very, very good instructions on burning the CD-ROMs. So, good. That's not a big problem. I've got CD record. I know how to use it. Fire it up. Burn the CD-ROMs. They don't work. Not only don't they work, they didn't work on three different machines. So what's he supposed to do? What can he do? Well, the fact is that the disks that I bought burn fine. They just won't read in another burner. In fact, they wouldn't even burn in, or wouldn't even read in mine after they were burnt. It's my burner. It's my hardware. That's my problem. So I don't know exactly how Fernando can address it, other than saying, you may have problems with your hardware that we cannot anticipate. Laptops. Yeah, everybody, laptops and sound. This is one of the reasons why I say maybe you shouldn't say if ALSA supports it, Ardor will run on it. Just think laptop. I mean, sure, ALSA does support it, and they'll work, and you know the drivers will work, but maybe not. You know, again, the chipset may be supported by ALSA, and it still won't work. Well, we all know it's largely because of the peculiarities of laptops, not because of the peculiarities of ALSA. So again, this brings me back to the importance of troubleshooting guides, of telling users that things may go wrong, and here's what you need to do about it, which includes, you know, buying another sound card or using another laptop. I honestly believe that at this point, developers should be very specific about what they know will work, what hardware they know it will work on. Paul's site, I think the Ardor documentation is very clear about that. And quite a lot of the applications that are showing up will say it works on this. But I think more applications and more developers need to address that. Test it on something, recommend that something. Give users a chance to, you know, get it right the first time. And let them know that anything else they try it on, well, you can't be certain it will run on that. So if I'm kind of hammering home the whole notion of troubleshooting, it's because, if you've been here for the last 2 days, you see that we have troubles. And while developers aren't all that concerned, that's what you do. You develop out of problems, right? The user doesn't come from that point of view. So, okay. So there's tutorials. There's troubleshooting guides. These things need to be done. And the more clearly they're written, the better it's going to be for the end user. A while ago, Patrick Shirky and I started what we call the Quick Toots. And the good fortune about those is that while users and developers write them, they go through an editorial process with Patrick and myself. That's pretty helpful. It helps clarify the presentation of the material, helps organize it maybe a little bit better. I'm kind of surprised, too, because some users write excellent documentation. They write good tutorials, and very helpful tutorials. And others... Jeez, they shouldn't have written at all. Okay, let's see. Frank says peace, everyone. Yeah, well, he'll let me know when it's 1 minute, I'm sure. before I go, though, and like I say, I apologize for the rambling, but you can consider this a John Cage sort of... ramble. Many of you know that my publisher has invited me to write a second edition of my book, and as I mentioned earlier, I'm kind of two minds about doing it. But I would like to hear opinions from people about do you think it should be done? I mean, it's good advertisement and promotion, but do we really need it in the light of the increasing amount and I think the increasing sophistication of documentation that's appearing. So with that, thank you very much, and I ended before my 2 minutes are up, right? Okay. Are there any questions? Anything at all, by the way, not just documentation. Willing to talk about anything.
Questions? Oh, okay, just one question maybe, but no more than...
You're...
Okay, over here.
Yeah, I have to try to summarize. I see... pretty busy at the moment. Wait a minute. Oh, another half a page from Bob Ham. Hang on a second. Okay. The first question I have in my queue right now is that Levy Burton would like to know, at what point in the development process should documentation be considered?
From the beginning, as far as reference and the developer's documentation is concerned, but I would say, actually from the beginning, to have a conceptual overview of what the software is going to do, and then wait until it actually does something, and start from there.
Okay, one more question, or rather a comment from Bob Ham. I mean, he writes, the problem is a lot of developers don't get problems. The software they use, or we use, he writes, works because we all have the latest up-to-date versions, and if it doesn't work, we can fix it. The problem of lack of troubleshooting guides, etc., is that users don't tell us what goes wrong. Mostly they're behind the times compared to developers, so a lot of the time the problems that users have disappeared if they contact developers. It's a problem in the nature of open source development. I suppose the question is, can you make more people send us good, detailed bug reports, please?
That's actually a very good question, because I was talking to Steve about things like stress tests, regression tests, and so forth. I would suggest to developers that if you want user feedback, give them a feedback form. Write a one-page form with some of the strongest questions you can think of to ask, really basic questions, and put it on page one. It's true. The most often heard remark from Windows developers is they never hear from people, you know, but they need to. I mean, all developers need to hear from the end users, so especially open source developers.
Okay, at this point...
I have something else to say, Frank, so too bad for you. I would like to, first of all, give enormous thanks to Jaroslav Casella and Paul Davis for their work on ALSA, and Jack, and, well, Takashi. He's a part of the team. He knows it. So. But truly, all the ALSA developers and the Jack developers, I believe these are two of the most important things to have happened for Linux Audio. It's phenomenal what they've achieved, and also what they imply for the future. It guarantees us a professional quality platform. I mean, if all you want to do is do your MP3s, fine. You're going to do it on a professionally capable platform. I think that's important just right there. I would also like to thank Sedka M for having all of us here, and particularly to Frank Neumann, Gert Stieper, and Matthias Nagorny. Thank you all. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dave. Yes, we delayed the delay again. So we have a slight problem now. The problem is that we planned the Linux Sound Night, as we called it, to start at 8:30. It's now almost 9. And we reserved our desk at the restaurant for 10. So this thing will have to be shortened a bit, because mostly I am hungry. But still, what we are trying to do now is, I think, show one or two things that have been prepared a bit today. And the first thing, maybe, if it's possible, is to ask Paul once again to do a short presentation of Ardo, which has been mentioned so much today. Right before you start, okay, I also need to...